Welcome to the Bookshelf. I'm Chris Messini. Tonight, Tom Bacon concludes his readings from Old Times on the Mississippi by Mark Twain.
We come now to the final chapter in Old Times on the Mississippi, the story by Mark Twain that was serialized in Atlantic Monthly January through June of 1875. This is called The Pilot's Monopoly. One day on board the Alex Scott, my chief, Mr. Bixby, was crawling carefully through a close place at Cat Island, both leads going and everybody holding his breath. The captain, a nervous, apprehensive man, kept still as long as he could, but finally broke down and shouted from the hurricane deck, "For gracious sake, give her steam, Mr. Bixby, give her steam! She'll never raise the reef on this headway." For all the effect that was produced upon Mr. Bixby, one would have supposed that no remark had been made. But 5 minutes later, when the danger was past and the leads laid in, he burst instantly into a consuming fury and gave the captain the most admirable cursing I ever listened to. No bloodshed ensued, but that was because the captain's cause was weak, for ordinarily he was not a man to take correction quietly. Having now set forth in detail the nature of the science of piloting, and likewise described the rank which the pilot held among the fraternity of steamboatmen, this seems a fitting place to say a few words about an organization which the pilots once formed for the protection of their guild. It was curious and noteworthy in this that it was perhaps the compactest, the completest, and the strongest commercial organization ever formed among men. For a long time, wages had been $250 a month. But curiously enough, as steamboats multiplied and business increased, the wages began to fall little by little. It was easy to discover the reason of this. Too many pilots were being made. It was nice to have a cub, a steersman, to do all the hard work for a couple of years gratis, while his master sat on a high bench and smoked. All pilots and captains had sons or nephews who wanted to be pilots. By and by it came to pass that nearly every pilot on the river had a steersman. When a steersman had made an amount of progress that was satisfactory to any two pilots in the trade, they could get a pilot's license for him by signing an application directly to the United States Inspector. Nothing further was needed. Usually no questions were asked, no proof of capacity required. Very well. This growing swarm of new pilots began presently to undermine the wages in order to get berths. Too late, apparently, the Knights of the Tiller perceived their mistake. Plainly, something had to be done, and quickly. But what was to be the needful thing? A close organization. Nothing else would answer. To compass this seemed an impossibility, so it was talked and talked and then dropped. It was too likely to ruin whoever ventured to move in the matter. But at last, about a dozen of the boldest, and some of them the best, pilots on the river launched themselves into the enterprise and took all the chances. They got a special charter from the legislature with large powers under the name of the Pilots Benevolent Association, elected their officers, completed their organization, contributed capital, put association wages up to $250 at once, and then retired to their homes, for they were promptly discharged from employment. But there were two or three unnoticed trifles in their bylaws which had the seed of propagation in them. For instance, all idle members of the association in good standing were entitled to a pension of $25 a month. This began to bring in one straggler after another from the ranks of the new-fledged pilots in the dull summer season. Better have $25 than starve. The initiation fee was only $12, and no dues required from the unemployed. Also, the widows of deceased members in good standing could draw $25 per month and a certain sum for each of their children. Also, the said deceased would be buried at the association's expense. These things resurrected all the superannuated and forgotten pilots in the Mississippi Valley. They came from farms, they came from interior villages, they came from everywhere. They came on crutches, on drays, in ambulances, anyway, so they got there. They paid in their $12 and straight away began to draw out $25 a month and calculate their burial bills. By and by, all the useless, helpless pilots and a dozen first-class ones were in the association, and 9/10 of the best pilots out of it and laughing at it. It was the laughing stock of the whole river. Everybody joked about the bylaw requiring members to pay 10% of their wages every month into the treasury for the support of the association, whereas all the members were outcast and tabooed, and no one would employ them. Everybody was derisively grateful to the association for taking all the worthless pilots out of the way and leaving the whole field to the excellent and the deserving. And everybody was not only jocularly grateful for that, but for a result which naturally followed, namely, the gradual advance of wages as the busy season approached. Wages had gone up from the low figure of $100 a month to $125, and in some cases to $150. And it was great fun to enlarge upon the fact that this charming thing had been accomplished by a body of men, not one of whom received a particle of benefit from it. Some of the jokers used to call at the association rooms and have a good time chaffing the members and offering them the charity of taking them as steersmen for a trip so that they could see what the Forgotten River looked like. However, the association was content, or at least gave no sign to the contrary. Now and then it captured a pilot who was out of luck and added him to its list, and these later additions were very valuable, for they were good pilots. The incompetent ones had all been absorbed before. Well, as business freshened, wages climbed gradually up to $250, the association figure, and became firmly fixed there, and still without benefiting a member of that body, for no member was hired. The hilarity at the association's expense burst all bounds now. There was no end to the fun which that poor martyr had to put up with. However, it is a long lane that has no turning. Winter approached, business doubled and trebled, and an avalanche of Missouri, Illinois, and upper Mississippi riverboats came pouring down to take a chance in the New Orleans trade. All of a sudden, pilots were in great demand and were correspondingly scarce. The time for revenge was come. It was a bitter pill to have to accept association pilots at last, yet captains and owners agreed there was no other way. But none of these outcasts offered. So there was a still bitterer pill to be swallowed. They must be sought out and asked for their services. Captain Blank was the first man who found it necessary to take the dose, and he had been one of the loudest deriders of the organization. He hunted up one of the best of the association pilots and said, "Well, you boys have rather got the best of us for a little while, so I'll give in with as good a grace as I can. I've come to hire you. Get your trunk aboard right away. I want to leave at 12 o'clock." "I don't know about that. Who's your other pilot?" "I've got I.S. "Why?" "I can't go with him. He don't belong to the association." "What?" "It's so." "Do you mean to tell me you won't turn a wheel with one of the very best and oldest pilots on the river because he don't belong to your association?" "Yes, I do." "Well, if this isn't putting on airs, I supposed I was doing you a benevolence, but I begin to think that I'm the party who wants a favor done. Are you acting under a law of the concern?" "Yep." "Show it to me." So they stepped into the association rooms, and the secretary soon satisfied the captain, who said, "Well, what am I to do? I've hired Mr. S. for the entire season." "I'll provide for you," said the secretary. "I will detail a pilot to go with you, and he shall be on board at 12 o'clock. But if I discharge S., he'll come with me for the whole season's wages." "Of course, that's a matter between you and Mr. S., Captain. We cannot meddle in your private affairs." The captain stormed, but to no purpose, and in the end he had to discharge S., pay him about $1,000, and take an association pilot in his place. The laugh was beginning to turn the other way now. Every day thenceforward a new victim fell, and every day some outraged captain discharged a non-association pet with tears and profanity and installed a hated association man in his berth. In a very little while, idle non-associationists began to be pretty plenty, brisk as business was, and much as their services were desired. The laugh was shifting to the other side of their mouths most palpably. These victims, together with the captains and owners, presently ceased to laugh altogether and began to rage about the revenge they would take when the passing business spurt was over. Soon all the laughers that were left were the pilots and crews of boats that had two non-association pilots. But their triumph was not very long-lived for this reason. It was a rigid rule of the association that its members should never, under any circumstances whatever, give information about the channel to any outsider. By this time, about half the boats had none but association pilots, and the other half had none but outsiders. At first glance, one would suppose that when it came to forbidding information about the river, these two parties could play equally at that game, but this was not so. At every good-sized town, from one end of the river to the other, there was a wharf boat to land at instead of a wharf or a pier. Freight was stored in it for transportation. Waiting passengers slept in its cabins. Upon each of these wharf boats, the association officers placed a strong box fastened with a peculiar lock which was used in no other service but one, the United States Mail Service. It was the letter bag lock, a sacred governmental thing. By dint of much beseeching, the government had been persuaded to allow the association to use this lock. Every association man carried a key which would open those boxes. That key, or rather a particular way of holding it in the hand when its owner was asked for river information by a stranger, for the success of the St. Louis and New Orleans Association had now bred tolerably thriving branches in a dozen neighboring steamboat trades, was the association man's sign and diploma of membership. And if the stranger did not respond by producing a similar key and holding it in a certain manner duly prescribed, his question was politely ignored. From the association's secretary, each member received a package of more or less gorgeous blanks, printed like a billhead on handsome paper, properly ruled in columns. A billhead worded something like this: Steamer Great Republic, John Smith Master, Pilots, John Jones, and Thomas Browns. And it had blanks for crossings, soundings, marks, and remarks. These blanks were filled up day by day as the voyage progressed and deposited in the several wharf boat boxes. For instance, as soon as the first crossing out from St. Louis was completed, the items would be entered upon the blank under the appropriate headings thus: St. Louis, 9.5 feet, stern on courthouse, head on dead cottonwood above woodyard until you raise the first reef, then pull up square. Then under head of remarks, go just outside the wrecks. This is important. New snag just where you straighten down. Go above it. The pilot who deposited that blank in the Cairo box, after adding to it details of every crossing all the way down from St. Louis, took out and read half a dozen fresh reports from upward-bound steamers concerning the river between Cairo and Memphis, posted himself thoroughly, returned them to the box, and went back aboard his boat again so armed against accidents that he could not possibly get his boat into trouble without bringing the most ingenious carelessness to his aid. Imagine the benefits of so admirable a system in a piece of river 1,200 or 1,300 miles long whose channel was shifting every day. The pilot, who had formerly been obliged to put up with seeing a shoal place once or possibly twice a month, had 100 sharp eyes to watch it for him now, and bushels of intelligent brains to tell him how to run it. His information about it was seldom 24 hours old. If the reports in the last box chanced to leave any misgivings on his mind concerning a treacherous crossing, he had his remedy. He blew his steamboat whistle in a peculiar way as soon as he saw a boat approaching. The signal was answered in a peculiar way if that boat's pilots were association men. Then the two steamers would range alongside, and all uncertainties were swept away by fresh information furnished to the inquirer by word of mouth and in minute detail. The first thing a pilot did when he reached New Orleans or St. Louis was to take his final and elaborate report to the association parlors and hang it up there, after which he was free to visit his family. In these parlors, a crowd was always gathered together discussing changes in the channel, and the moment there was a fresh arrival, everybody stopped talking until this witness had told the latest news and settled the latest uncertainty. Other craftsmen can sink the shop sometimes and interest themselves in other matters. Not so with a pilot. He must devote himself wholly to his profession and talk of nothing else, for it would be small gain to be perfect one day and imperfect the next. He has no time or words to waste if he would keep posted. But the outsiders had a hard time of it. No particular place to meet and exchange information, no wharf boat reports, none but chance and unsatisfactory ways of getting news. The consequence was that a man sometimes had to run 500 miles of river on information that was a week or 10 days old. At a fair stage of the river, that might have answered, but when the dead low water came, it was destructive. Now came another perfectly logical result. The outsiders began to ground steamboats, sink them, and get in all sorts of trouble, whereas accidents seemed to keep entirely away from the association men. Wherefore, even the owners and captains of boats furnished exclusively with outsiders, and previously considered to be wholly independent of the association, and free to comfort themselves with brag and laughter, began to feel pretty uncomfortable. Still, they made a show of keeping up the brag, until one black day when every captain of the lot was formally ordered to immediately discharge his outsiders and take association pilots in their stead. And who was it that had the dashing presumption to do that? Alas, it came from a power behind the throne that was greater than the throne itself. It was the underwriters. It was no time to swap knives. Every outsider had to take his trunk ashore at once. Of course, it was supposed that there was collusion between the association and the underwriters, but this was not so. The latter had come to comprehend the excellence of the report system of the association and the safety it secured, and so they had made a decision among themselves and upon plain business principles. There was weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth in the camp of the outsiders now, but no matter, there was but one course for them to pursue, and they pursued it. They came forward in couples and groups and proffered their $12 and asked for membership. They were surprised to learn that several new bylaws had been long ago added. For instance, the initiation fee had been raised to $50. That sum must be tendered, and also 10% of the wages which the applicant had received each and every month since the founding of the association. In many cases, this amounted to $300 or $400. Still, the association would not entertain the application until the money was present. Even then, a single adverse vote killed the application. Every member had to vote yes or no in person and before witnesses, so it took weeks to decide a candidacy because many pilots were so long absent on voyages. However, the repentant sinners scraped their savings together, and one by one, by our tedious voting process, they were added to the fold. A time came at last when only about 10 remained outside. They said they'd starve before they'd apply. They remained idle a long while because, of course, nobody would venture to employ them. By and by, the association published the fact that upon a certain date, the wages would be raised to $500 a month. All the branch associations had grown strong now, and the Red River one had advanced wages to $700 a month. Reluctantly, the 10 outsiders yielded in view of these things and made application. There was another new bylaw by this time, which required them to pay dues not only on all the wages they had received since the association was born, but also on what they would have received if they had continued to work up to the time of their application instead of going off to pout in idleness. It turned out to be a difficult matter to elect them, but this was accomplished at last. The most virulent sinner of this batch had stayed out and allowed dues to accumulate him so long he had to send in $675 with his application. The association had a good bank account now and was very strong. There was no longer an outsider. A bylaw was added forbidding the reception of any more cubs or apprentices for 5 years, after which time a limited number would be taken, not by individuals, but by the association upon these terms. The applicant must be not less than 18 years old, of respectable family and good character. He must pass an examination as to education, pay $1,000 in advance for the privilege of becoming an apprentice, and must remain under the command of the association until a great part of the membership, more than half, I think, should be willing to sign his application for a pilot's license. All previously articled apprentices were now taken away from their masters and adopted by the association. The president and secretary detailed them for service on one boat or another as they chose, and changed them from boat to boat according to certain rules. If a pilot could show that he was in infirm health and needed assistance, one of the cubs would be ordered to go with him. The widow and orphan list grew, but so did the association's financial resources. The association attended its own funerals in state and paid for them. When occasion demanded, it sent members down the river upon searches for the bodies of brethren lost by steamboat accidents. A search of this kind could cost $1,000. The association procured a charter and went into the insurance business also. It not only insured the lives of its members, but took risks on steamboats. The organization seemed indestructible. It was the tightest monopoly in the world. By the United States law, no man can become a pilot unless two duly licensed pilots signed his application and now there was nobody outside of the association competent to sign. Consequently, the making of pilots was at an end. Each year, some would die, and others would become incapacitated by age and infirmity, and there would be no new ones to take their places. In time, the association could put wages up to any figure it chose, and so long as it should be wise enough not to carry the thing too far and provoke the national government into amending the licensing system, steamboat owners would have to submit, since there would be no help for it. The owners and captains were the only obstruction that lay between the association and absolute power, and at last this one was removed. Incredible as it may seem, the owners and captains deliberately did it themselves. When the Pilots Association announced, months beforehand, that on the first day of September 1861, wages would be advanced to $500 a month, the owners and captains instantly put freight up a few cents and explained to the farmers along the river the necessity of it by calling their attention to the burdensome rate of wages about to be established. It was a rather slender argument, but the farmers didn't seem to detect it. It looked reasonable to them that to add 5 cents freight on a bushel of corn was justifiable under the circumstances, overlooking the fact that this advance on a cargo of 40,000 sacks was a good deal more than necessary to cover the new wages. So straight away, the captains and owners got up an association of their own and proposed to put captains' wages up to $500, too, and to move for another advance in freights. It was a novel idea, but of course an effect which had been produced once could be produced again. The new association decreed, for this was before all the outsiders had been taken into the Pilots Association, that if any captain employed a non-association pilot, he should be forced to discharge him and also pay a fine of $500. Several of these heavy fines were paid before the captain's organization grew strong enough to exercise full authority over the membership, but all that ceased presently. The captains tried to get the pilots to decree that no member of their corporation should serve under a non-association captain, but this proposition was declined. The pilots saw that they would be backed up by the captains and the underwriters anyhow, so they wisely refrained from entering into entangling alliances. As I've remarked, the Pilots Association was now the compactest monopoly in the world, perhaps, and seemed simply indestructible. And yet the days of its glory were numbered. First, the new railroad stretching up through Mississippi, Tennessee, and Kentucky to northern railway centers began to divert passenger travel from the steamers. Next, the war came and almost entirely annihilated the steamboating industry during several years, leaving most of the pilots idle and the cost of living advancing all the time. Then the treasurer of the St. Louis Association put his hand into the till and walked off with every dollar of the ample fund. And finally, the railroads intruding everywhere, there was little for steamers to do when the war was over but carry freight. So straightway some genius from the Atlantic coast introduced the plan of towing a dozen steamer cargoes down to New Orleans at the tail of a vulgar little tugboat, and behold, in the twinkling of an eye, as it were, the association and the noble science of piloting were things of the dead and pathetic past. I've been reading from Mark Twain's Old Times on the Mississippi, his account of becoming a river pilot and the profession's arcane language from which he took his pen name. The Bookshelf is a production of KPBX in Spokane. Vern Windham, executive producer. I'm Tom Bacon.